In November, Utah Foundation held a breakfast briefing on the topic of homelessness, sponsored by the University of Utah's College of Social and Behavioral Science. Our panel of experts featured Tricia Davis of the Utah Homelessness Programs Office, longtime Utah Representative Eric Hutchings, Dr. Jeff Rose of the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism at the University of Utah, and Dr. Jesus Valero, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science, also at the University of Utah. The panelists addressed several key questions. How have Utah's homeless service providers dealt with the pandemic? Where are the efforts to address service gaps going? And how should we approach those who remain on the streets from a policy standpoint? In this edition of Utah Thrives, you'll hear highlights from that conversation. This is Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. Homelessness is a visible reminder of the many personal tragedies that our fellow citizens struggle with, from family breakdown to mental health problems to struggles with substance abuse. The homeless are living lives that they certainly never would have dreamed of when they were children. Their struggles are not only private, however, their struggles ripple through society and our economy. Utah Foundation has launched a series of reports examining homelessness. The question before us today is how best to grapple with this momentous challenge of homelessness. We'll turn to Tricia Davis, who is manager of the State of Utah's Homelessness Programs Office. Tricia?
I'd just like to start by kind of explaining, I don't know that a lot of folks around the state understand what the current structure of the state homelessness programs office is, or what is really happening in homelessness from a statewide kind of governance perspective. So we're an office of nine. I like to say that we're small but mighty, and are the state staffing support for the State Homeless Coordinating Committee. We support 13 local homeless coordinating committees around the state, and the staffing support for the Utah Homeless Management Information System, which that is an acronym that I might end up slipping out, so I wanted to just mention that here. We are the staffing support for what is being developed as a data leadership committee and the Utah Homeless Network. The State Homeless Coordinating Committee adopted a Utah strategic plan on homelessness just last year. So we're really looking at the implementation of that plan. We manage and allocate about $21.5 million out to homeless service providers throughout the state, and do that through some different processes with a lot of strong involvement from the local homeless coordinating committees. We also recently released the Utah Annual Report on Homelessness, which is our data report, and it is our 2020 report. And we're heavily involved in coordinating the annual point in time count, which, if you're familiar with this world, you've probably heard of. And we have data regarding that count in our most recent report. One of the things that's really been kind of pushed into fast motion with our office is the support of the Utah Homeless Network and the response of homeless service providers from around the state. We have these calls weekly, and if you are interested in participating in those conversations and hearing what's going on around the state, we know from different research that's been done, Columbia University released some research around homelessness and what to expect in COVID-19, and we know that that research showed that there would be a 40 to 45% increase in homelessness in relation to this pandemic. So that is something we talk a lot about and are looking at. Typically, 53% of Utah's homeless families and 71% of Utah's homeless individuals exit emergency shelters within 1 month of entering them. We also see, like from research that's been done, it's usually around 14 days that people self-resolve. So when we're talking about, you know, some of the really obvious signs of homelessness, we're talking about people who have been on the streets or been in shelters for longer periods of time. Homeless resource centers and emergency shelter capacity has certainly been impacted. and there's been expansion of quarantine and isolation sites around the state. I think it's important to note in these conversations that 22% of individuals from the point in time count, which is a count that happens on one day in January, so this is from the 2020 point in time count, were determined to be chronically homeless. That's 688 individuals. Those are individuals who have experienced homelessness for at least a year or repeatedly while struggling with a disabling condition, serious mental illness, substance use disorder, or physical disability. So when we're talking about policy and what impacts we can have on different services, I think it's important to keep that group in mind. Also important, I think, to realize and recognize is that 20% report substance use disorders and 31% of individuals report mental illness. There's often a lot of discussion around, you know, what are the causes of homelessness? We know they're very complex. But if you look at those numbers, I think, you know, we've got to do some analysis, but those are interesting to note. I also wanted to mention that we had developed an unsheltered toolkit for communities in partnership with the Department of Public Safety in 2018. I probably just want to emphasize the impact that domestic violence has had during this pandemic, and that when a family enters into a domestic violence service provider or shelter, that they are also considered homeless. And so homelessness is a complex social issue, and the economic problems that affects, you know, it really impacts people from all walks of life and for many, many different reasons. So, I will just mention our 2020 data report supports the need for expanding effective and efficient homeless prevention programs, rapid rehousing and diverse housing options, and permanent supportive housing options.
Thank you, Tricia. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Jesus Valero. He's an assistant professor in the political science department at the University of Utah. And Jesus is also the primary author of an ongoing series of reports on homelessness from Utah Foundation. Jesus?
So in the spring of 2020, we began a research effort to understand the service gaps in our local homeless service system. This topic has been a great priority for local stakeholders and also informed by the statewide strategic plan that Tricia just mentioned. But because of the coronavirus pandemic, however, our project was brought to a quick halt. So after a few months into the pandemic, a collaborative discussion was had with leaders of the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness, and we decided to turn our attention to studying the effects of the pandemic in our local community of homeless service providers, specifically in Salt Lake County. So since the pandemic began, and as of October 28th, over 400 individuals experiencing homelessness in Salt Lake County have contracted COVID-19. It has become imperative to understand the challenges that providers are experiencing and to develop an understanding of how they are confronting the pandemic and to develop a set of best practices for providers, not just here locally, but in other parts of our state as well. So our work has been guided by a couple of research questions. First, what are the effects of the pandemic on providers and what challenges are they experiencing? And second, what innovations and coping strategies are providers adopting to mitigate the effects of the pandemic? So to answer these questions, we set out to launch a series of small surveys. The first survey was launched on May 15th with a focus on understanding the effects of COVID-19. We identified a total of 148 service providers and achieved a 55% response rate. The second survey was launched on July 20th, and it was focused on understanding the mitigation strategies and innovations with a 32% response rate. We have a third survey that we'll be launching soon with a specific focus on the long-term service gaps within the homeless service system, with specific attention to the impact of COVID. So in May, we asked providers, we wanted to know the extent to which we're able to keep doors open during the pandemic. A little over 20% reported that they were maintaining their services at the same sort of level and format of provision. About 15% noted that their services had been reduced as a result of the pandemic. And about 28% noted that their services had been transitioned to online environments. Fast forward to July, we asked the extent to which they're returning back to normal and where they're at since the reopening of our local economy. And what's interesting is that the percentage of providers that are providing services in online formats or in hybrid formats almost more than doubled. 52% noted that their services continue to be provided in hybrid form, so online plus a blend of in-person with social distancing. About 20% noted that their services were back to normal with social distancing measures and other health precautions, so not necessarily providing them online. We wanted to know the extent to which the pandemic was challenging provider survivability. You know, this is a crucial question to understand. Just generally, you know, how are they doing as a result of the pandemic? Are they doing okay? Are they able to keep their doors open as a result of our health pandemic? 11% noted that their survivability was being challenged to a great extent, which is, you know, good news. But at the same time, about 34% said sort of the next degree there, that their survivability was being challenged. So a little over 40%, about 45% of providers are responding that their survivability is being challenged to at least a somewhat level of challenge. About 34% noted that very little of their survivability was being challenged, and 21% not at all, which is fantastic to see that there are some providers that are faring well and keeping their doors open and not being challenged. So that's a testament to their institutional sort of efforts and their ability to maintain resource provision in our local community. We wanted to know more specifically about what challenges these providers were facing. So this is just a sample of some of these challenges. We just asked a open-ended question of what are you facing? Not surprising, maybe to many of us, that the health safety of their staff was the top concern, with 57% of providers in our survey noting that the health safety of their staff was a significant concern, quickly followed by a reduction or loss of financial resources. So as a result of the pandemic, you know, less service provision, for example, less of those service revenues coming back to the organization. So they're losing some of those supports. So 51% again are responding that they're losing that reduction of or losing financial resources. Also not surprising, about 43% are noting that an increased demand for services, as Tricia just mentioned, there are some subpopulations that are specifically facing challenges as a result of the pandemic. And so there is an increased demand for services from those populations. Also of no surprise to me, and perhaps to a number of us here, is that just as the health safety of staff is a concern, maintaining morale and motivation among their staff is also a significant challenge. The staff are being stretched thin. They're facing significant sort of challenges in maintaining the safety of their clients. And so these sort of increased demands and pressures on them is challenging their ability to maintain that level of motivation. Also, the turn to providing services strictly online and not maintaining sort of those social networks and connections with both clients and staff is paying placing some challenges on their ability to stay motivated. And then a few others here, reduction, loss of available volunteers is another challenge. Telecommuting, clients refusing to adhere to social distancing are among those challenges. Good news for a lot of us as well is the least reported challenge is a lack of collaboration within our homeless network here locally. So that is a testament to the leadership of the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness and the commitment of providers to maintain strong connections with each other in order to cope with the challenges of the pandemic. So this is a set of good news there. Lastly, we wanted to know specifically about the strategies that providers are adopting and the extent to which any of these strategies are reported to be more effective than others in their ability to cope with the challenges that the pandemic is sort of bringing upon these service providers. Again, collaboration seems to be key and incredibly important to service providers in their ability to withstand the effects of the pandemic. Participating in county COVID-19 coordination calls was the top reported strategy and also the top effective strategy to cope with the pandemic. So again, a testament to the incredible work that is happening here locally of providers coming together, sharing information, resources, staying connected, and wanting to work together in order to withstand the effects of the pandemic. Creating an internal COVID-19 response team has also been an important strategy that providers are adopting, maintaining sort of close communication and coordination within the organization, and creating intra-organizational collaboration has been incredibly important. Applying for CARES Act funding, accessing existing partnerships, engaging in advocacy, working remotely has also paid dividends for organizations, and making changes to programming or services has been effective for providers as well. So just a sample of some of these strategies that organizations are adopting, and also a set of best practices as well. For organizations that may not be adopting some of these strategies, these could be set as potential best practices that they can adopt in order to be more effective at withstanding the effects of the pandemic. And so these are just a sample of some of these data points. More data and complete reports on these first two surveys are available on the Utah Foundation website.
Thank you, Jesus. Next, let's turn to Dr. Jeff Rose. Jeff is assistant professor lecturer in the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism at the University of Utah. Jeff?
I approach homelessness, and particularly the question of unsheltered homelessness, from a little bit more of a qualitative or an ethnographic standpoint. We're really trying to understand people's lived experiences as they move through homelessness. And I think one of the things that I want to remind folks is that unsheltered homelessness is perhaps the most visible portion of homelessness that many people see on a daily basis, but it also represents a very small portion of overall homelessness. Depends on how it's defined and things like that, but it may be as little as 5% of overall homelessness nationwide and locally as well. Unsheltered homelessness, most people think that this subpopulation is the most vulnerable. These are people who experience the worst health outcomes. These are the people who are most likely to experience chronic homelessness, where they have an additional disabling condition, where they experience long-term homelessness. And these are folks who are in most need of services. So a couple of kind of key data points that from my engagement with people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness is that the homeless resource centers that are available in Salt Lake City are perceived to be inaccessible by a large portion of people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness. And this is for a number of reasons, some of which are understandable and maybe some of which are less commonly thought of, but they're seen as spaces of transmission of the COVID, of the coronavirus and COVID-19. And so these are perceived, despite numerous efforts on the part of HRCs, they're seen as spaces of unhealthiness. They're also seen as having decreased services in the wake of COVID-19. The perception is that they are less accessible than they were back in March or February or before the pandemic really took root in the United States. Tricia earlier mentioned quarantine and isolation facilities, which are often local motels and hotels that are provided for people to basically provide shelter for them during difficult times. And these services are perceived as unavailable and extremely temporary by people who are facing unsheltered homelessness. And so a lot of times this breaks out across gender divides, across age divides, across family status divides and things like that. But there's a perception that these Q&I facilities are largely unavailable. And then I think the last piece that might be important to recognize is that people who are facing unsheltered homelessness recognize the decentralization process that is primarily associated with the closing of the Downtown Road Home shelter as being an effort to decrease services for the Salt Lake's homeless community. And again, these are internal perceptions of that. The second piece that I think is maybe worth thinking through is that encampments are seen by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as a place of potentially high COVID transmission, but also a space where folks can find resources and find some sense of security during a time that's fairly destabilizing. And so the CDC has released some guidelines for encampments, and I'll just hit a couple of the high points of these things. The recommendations from the CDC say that there's an increased risk of severe illness from COVID-19 for people who are facing unsheltered homelessness. And this is due to a number of kind of often things that are considered comorbidities, including older age, chronic lung disease, heart conditions, diabetes, incoming health disparities that people in encampments tend to face. And so the recommendations are to provide increased hygiene materials, improve sanitation. And so this would look like making sure that there's restrooms available, making sure that there's hand sanitizer available, making sure that there's water and soap available, making sure that people are able to dispose of their waste, litter and human waste appropriately. And then the CDC has actually encouraged that there be social distancing within encampments. And so as possible, if encampments can spread out tents or sleeping shelters or sleeping spaces, and they recommend, you know, a 12-foot by 12-foot space for each individual or each unit within an encampment. And then the last recommendation from the CDC that is, a little bit controversial, but I think is worth stating, again, this is our federal government's guidelines, is that we should allow people to remain in encampments. And the idea here is that encampments, despite their difficulties and their health concerns, are also spaces of stability, and not only health stability, but also social stability and community stability and things of that nature. And so the CDC recommended putting a halt on clearing encampments, putting a halt on, you know, evicting people from these public spaces where they're most visible.
Thank you, Dr. Rose. Finally, we will hear from Representative Eric Hutchings, who has served as a state legislator for 2 decades. Representative?
I got a little bit of good news. I know homelessness is never kind of an easy subject to talk about, but every once in a while, it's kind of nice to see a little bit of positive change. And while we're obviously not there, we're not done, it has been my privilege, you guys, to work in the Utah legislature on a lot of criminal justice related issues. I have led some major reform issues around that, the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, the adult programs, juvenile programs. And the reason why I think this is so important is I think the homeless population is vulnerable in a lot of different ways, a lot of ways that the regular population just isn't. And you saw in there, especially with the chronic homelessness, that you know, there's a lot of mental health issues, there's a lot of substance abuse issues. And when you start tracking that back to how we've handled that population and the interrelationship it's had with law enforcement, we haven't done a great job on both sides, because number one, we haven't interacted well with that population in trying to help get them into resources. But number two, we haven't been able to find a really good way to protect them either. They are the most vulnerable, in my opinion, of being taken advantage of by organized crime. When you look at drug cartels, when you look at human trafficking, when you look at all of those issues, they are so extremely vulnerable. And so over the last few years, we have worked to make some changes there. And I've had the opportunity to work on that both at the state level and at the national level with the National Council of State Governments and the National Conference of State Legislatures. And you guys, it's kind of exciting that things have changed. And so one of the big things that I'll mention is we have been pushing away from criminalizing homelessness. And it's, I know it's just kind of a little baby effort that's just getting started, but we are shifting the way that we have interacted with this population in a dramatic way. Let me give you a simple, for instance, Davis County is the first one that has been able to get it started up, but Davis County opened what's called a resource center. It's a diversion center, whatever you'd like to call it. But here's the really interesting thing about it. Now, when law enforcement has an interaction with somebody on the street and something's happening, maybe they're having an episode, we don't know. Maybe it's a drug-induced episode, maybe alcohol, maybe a mental health episode. Historically, the only resource that we had, and in the introduction, I've been around this game long enough that when I first got in the legislature, you guys, the mentality was hit them with a stick. And if a little stick didn't work, get a bigger stick. And if that didn't work, get a bigger stick and just keep whooping people until somehow there was a behavioral change, right? We have shifted away from that in such a great way, because now starting with the first physical facility in Davis County, stood up by the council up there, their county commissioners and the sheriff. You'd be really surprised. The two big drivers of that were the chief of police for Bountiful and the Davis County sheriff. And their argument is, we know these people that get out on the streets and have troubles, and arresting them and incarcerating them is not helping to solve this problem. And so we have legalized and changed the statutes and allowed now in the state of Utah for law enforcement to be able to have these interactions. When somebody calls 911 and says, there's a guy behind my restaurant who is losing it, the question then becomes, losing it why? And it doesn't have to be criminal. Is he hurting anybody? If he's not hurting anybody, law enforcement can literally roll up and say, let's get you someplace where we can get you some help. And we can take them now to these diversion centers, these resource centers, and it's non-criminal, you guys. We never even book. There's no mugshot. There's no case file. There's no involvement with a judge. There's none of that stuff there. It's actually run by the one in Davis County. Is run by Davis Behavioral. And so when they walk in, the very first thing is to triage them. What in the world is going on? What's happening with you? And the neat thing is, we can take everybody. We have a facility now for juveniles if they have issues that has been wildly successful. And we have an adult facility for both males and females. It's a short-term stay. It's not intended to keep them there long. It's intended to help them triage, to make sure that we figure out what in the world is going on with you. But the beautiful thing is now, when law enforcement has these interactions, it's no longer about giving you one more negative thing on a criminal record that now you're going to have to deal with. It's truly, honestly supported by law enforcement, but 100% outside of the criminal justice system. And I love that. And it's becoming successful enough that we've actually just recently opened our second one down in Washington County in St. George. And it's a cool story, you guys. We have reformed the system enough that we took a juvenile lockup facility and took so many kids out of it that it was empty, vacant. And so we actually, as a state, partnered with Washington County and gave them a sweetheart deal on picking up the building. And now they have the same type of facility down in Washington County, because the people need support. They need help. When you're dealing with that chronic group that very, very often has a lot of times a dual diagnosis with mental health and substance abuse issues, we're now able to get them connected to resources. And we're starting to put those types of programs up and down the state. And it's a national effort. There's definitely a mindset shift. And it doesn't just allow us an opportunity to get them substance abuse and mental health supports. It also allows us to have a talk with them about, what do you need vocationally? What do you need in all those other things? Because your survey, I thought your survey was great. But the answer is, honestly, all of the above, right? Because there's some are going to need one thing, some are going to need something else. And for us to be able to provide the opportunity to sit down and really have an opportunity to talk to that person and then send them out and get them connected to the right resources, it has been the neatest criminal justice reform effort I've ever been a part of. And I think it's going to have a major impact in our ability to support and protect the homeless population in the state of Utah, because they're going to start to recognize, hopefully very soon, that law enforcement is not there to cause them a problem. They are there to help get them to safety and to get them to some place where they can be protected and supported and have some wraparound services provided to them. And anyway, I think we're on a really good path. And again, not done by any means, but man, we're making good progress. And so I look forward to sharing more information maybe in the future. Hopefully we'll have another couple of those stood up and opened up this year. Again, to the Utah Foundation, thanks for all that you guys do.
Thank you, Representative. What are some of the measures we should have in place at the state and local levels to prevent homelessness from occurring in the first place? Tricia, do you wanna go first on that?
Ooh, to prevent homelessness. Yeah, you know, that's something we're talking a lot about. We did receive, you'll hear CARES Act funding, but there were different pots of funding that the state received through that. And we received about $14 million in what we call the Emergency Solutions Grant. And our focus, we received two rounds of that funding. Our focus for the first round was rapid rehousing and homeless prevention, to your point, Peter. And then our second round was focused on emergency shelter, street outreach, homeless prevention, and rapid rehousing. So if we're talking really about homeless prevention, it's important, I think, when we're talking about that to really design programs that are, like I said before, efficient and effective. Not everybody that is facing eviction right now will necessarily end up homeless. So we've got to be looking at really like the folks that are facing literal homelessness, and HUD's programs are really designed. Those programs are really designed to focus on literally homeless and those who are at imminent risk of homelessness. And so I really think about focusing our funding and our dollars right now related to the CARES Act on efficient and effective programs and identifying the people who are at the door of homelessness.
Pamela Atkinson and many others are famous for saying the solution to homelessness is housing. I think that's worth stating at multiple different levels. I believe the poll had a few different types of housing, and I think that's important to emphasize. And then secondly, direct support to participants to those facing homelessness has been shown to work. There's been a number of kind of programs that where people who are facing unsheltered homelessness in particular are given resources and supports, and it's shown that the vast majority of them exit homelessness within usually 10 to 20 months or something like that. And so I think those kinds of programs deserve attention and some thought.
Let's get specific on that one real quick. What are some of the tried and true strategies we know of now that our homeless service providers can use to move homeless people toward better mental health and self-sufficiency?
I'm actually going to give you maybe a little bit of a twist on that. I think we're really refocusing on the fact that we have to provide that is a big element, especially of chronic homelessness from the population that I'm most familiar with. There's a lot of other things like vocational training and income that deal with other populations. But Peter, on this one, we ran into something very bizarre this year, and not just COVID related, but there's actually some good news in relationship to this COVID related. But providing mental health, we actually, for the first time ever, there's enough money, we cannot find providers. We have actually run into a situation where we have now recognized that demand is massive and the provider pool is tiny. And so when you have somebody that maybe gets in trouble with law enforcement and the judge is like, I'm not going to send them to jail. I need to send them to treatment. And the question is, treatment where? And so when you go to the community providers and you're like, hey, we need to expand capacity. And they're like, great, find me a therapist. Find me a therapist anywhere. So a couple of good news things, you guys. And again, just on the beginnings, but our Department of Professional Licensing has gone through all of the different types of licenses that somebody can get if they have a criminal background. So too many people that have been through processes like this want to get into counseling, become a social worker or something like that. And historically, they haven't been allowed to because they had something on their record. DOPPEL no longer has that limitation, you guys. It is a case by case. They have completely altered the way that they work. You can actually go to DOPPEL and say, if I were to get my degree, could I be licensed and go to work as a therapist or a social worker? And they will tell you beforehand, or they will tell you, you need to do this or you need to do that, and then we'll grant it. But we're in a spot right now, Peter, where especially on mental health and substance abuse, we have got to find a way to provide more resources, and telehealth is going to provide a massive amount of support in that case because we can get more people done in more areas of the state, especially rural. But we are really struggling right now to find just therapists. Our colleges, unfortunately, at this point are doing everything they can, but we just don't have enough for the demand that's out there.
Sure. Jesus, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been said that homelessness is a complex, multidimensional issue. But at the same time, it varies from community to community. The needs facing Salt Lake County are incredibly different from the challenges facing San Juan County, for example, which has a predominantly Native American community. And so in those particularly rural areas, it's so hard to find service providers. A year ago, when we were traveling, my colleague Lena Spadina and I for the work on our statewide strategic plan. There is motivation, there's interest, there's passion, but there is no service providers, you know, to address the specific needs of the individuals who are experiencing homelessness in those areas. So part of our recommendation was to strengthen the connections across the state. And I'm super excited to hear about the Utah Homeless Network and the work that they're doing, because I think this is part of that solution to better strengthen and connect rural communities to urban areas, and to share best practices, resources, and telehealth will be an important part of that solution, to take resources that are here, for example, in Salt Lake, to San Juan County and other parts of the state.
We have a question from the audience. Despite all the efforts around homelessness, why are our numbers continuing to increase?
We do talk about housing being the solution to homelessness. And I think that that is something that, as a state, we really do need to think about, you know, different housing, affordable housing options, available housing options, diverse housing options. We did a survey with, actually, Pamela really drove a survey that we did about a year and a half ago, around like, what did people really want, right? And it was a survey that was done in our emergency, in our homeless resource centers, and in the Wiegand Center downtown and with St. Vincent de Paul. And what people said is like, I just want a room. I don't need something fancy. I don't need a big kitchen. So we started talking a lot about single room occupancy units at that time. And really felt like that would be a great starting point. And we were listening to, you know, what individuals were telling us. When we look at that, I mean, the challenges are real when we talk about funding for projects like that, tax credits, different things that complicate, you know, building some of these different diverse housing options are real. And there were a couple of projects that we were really looking at, but ended up falling through with the Housing Authority of Salt Lake City. They're really focused on some of these diverse housing options. And I think that's what, to answer the question, I really do believe that we need more of those options. We know, I mean, it's widespread news that affordable housing is a huge challenge in communities across the nation. And that's what we hear. And so we really do need to focus on that if we want to make an impact. And now we're facing COVID-19, where there's the possibility of a 40 to 45% increase in homelessness. Like, this is a real issue. And when we're talking about the connection with housing and homelessness.
So we have a question here about balancing constituents seeking help whose businesses and livelihood are adversely affected by encampments with trying to be part of compassionate homeless solutions. That does seem to be a big question out there. Jeff, did you want to start on that?
You know, one of the things that I tend to think about this as a bit of a spatial problem as much as it is a social or political or economic problem. And so what I mean by that is where are the spaces in which people who are facing poverty or other insecurity can exist. A traditional approach to this is to place them in particular sections of town that isolate them and kind of remove them from society. You know, my perspective on this is that they are our community members, and we should all work hard to embrace them as much as possible. What does that mean when you're dealing with that on a day-to-day basis? Well, it probably means that we need to have some of the services that Trisha is mentioning, some of the services that Jesus is mentioning. You know, we need to have some of those social services involved. And as Representative Hutchins mentioned, we probably don't need to have these people involved in the criminal justice system. We need to have these people, you know, in supportive health-focused situations. And so I do think that there's a fundamental shift. And one of the things that we can think of is that folks are facing a sense of insecurity. And so how can we collectively as a community provide that sense of security on a daily basis? So the need to engage in criminal behavior or violent behavior, or have their mental health go unchecked is less likely.
Representative, you want to key in on that? And also, we've got another question here, if you could also address this. What does success look like? What measurements are we tracking to know whether we're making progress and having success?
I think Jeff has a great point. And I think maybe the silver lining behind all of this, things like telehealth, things that we really weren't pushing for too long ago have now come into mainstream, which is going to be a wonderful new tool for us to use to reach out. But I think one of the ways that we need to look at this is, you know, why, to the last question, why haven't we seen more progress? Guys, in our criminal reform work that we've done, until you turn the light on, until you start doing what you guys are doing, Jesus, Jeff, you guys, when you're doing your research, until you start getting quantitative numbers out there, how big's the problem? Oh, it's big. Oh, how many resources do we need? Oh, a lot. Well, it's really hard to fund a lot until you can get a real number around it. But then when you get a real number around it, oh, holy crap, it just seems so overwhelming. And people just like, oh my word, how are we ever going to handle this? But the reality is, I think, honestly, Peter, we need to start looking at this as not just an issue. It's not like, you know, we're going to put out all the house fires and then we're going to disband the fire department. We have a fire department for a reason. We have a, you know, a power company for a reason. We have meals on wheels for a reason, because as our population cycles through demographics, ages, all that kind of stuff, these issues, they're not just a temporary fix. And I would hope in our city planning, I would hope that in our legal planning. So for instance, we opened a courthouse, you guys, a cute little temporary thing in one of the homeless resource centers. I mean, it's just things like that that we've never done before. But the point is recognizing that this isn't just something that we need to have politicians and policymakers and funders work on and go, you know what, if we push hard, by March of next year, we'll be done with homelessness, right? And it'll be over and we won't have to deal with it. I think we really need to have a conversation about community planning, about zoning. Jeff's got a great point. Where is the space? Well, I can't open a business and I can't run my operation in the middle of the intersection on Fifth South and State. That's just not allowed. There's a certain time and a place and a thing where I can do certain types of functions. And I think we need to convince our governmental leaders, you guys, that as we go through this process, people are going to come into the experience and they're going to go out of the experience. The thing that we need to do is make sure that those resources are designed to be permanent and efficient and readily available. And we need to really change people's mindset that this isn't just like a Rio Grande thing where we're going to go in and do this big splash for a couple of months and then go away. We need to plan this into, just like we have a fire department, you know, we're going to be there. If something catches on fire, we're going to be there, and it needs to be permanent and it needs to be well-funded.
Jesus, I'll give you the last word. What are your thoughts on this?
I also want to point out that specific performance benchmarks have been identified as part of the statewide strategic plan on homelessness. The state has prioritized four performance areas, fewer days spent in emergency beds, fewer persons returning to homelessness, fewer first-time individuals who experience homelessness, and more persons successfully retaining housing. And the specific sort of goal that the state is trying to achieve within a five-year sort of performance effort is to reduce some of these by 10% or increase by 10%, or to exceed the performance of scores for continuums of care within Western states. So just want to encourage everyone to go and read the statewide strategic plan on homelessness and to take a close look at those priority performance measures that have been identified and that we're all working towards, you know, in working as a collaborative unit.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.